We gather for worship this day, mindful that 300 years ago, the pioneering forefathers and foremothers of this congregation made real their vision of gathering a new worshiping community and, without permission, building a meeting house of their own on Peter's Hill. The world has changed dramatically in the past three centuries, but we can be assured that the yearnings of the human heart for love and acceptance and the longings of the human spirit to stand awed and humbled before the sacred mystery of God and of life were not so different for the 32 forebears who signed the petition to create the Second Church of Roxbury than they are for us this day, as we celebrate in grateful thanksgiving the bonds of the covenant of this faith community through the ages. Welcome. We especially welcome the past ministers who are here. Some are here in body and others in spirit. And we welcome everyone on this historic day to worship, to celebrate, and be part of the journey. Following the service, please join us in Parish Hall for coffee hour, and then be sure to come back at 2 p.m. for the dramatization and the music celebrating 300 years. And now, please stand as you are able as we join in saying together the chalice lighting words that are printed in your order of service. Let us covenant together, sharing the strength of integrity, the heritage of the Spirit, and the unending quest for truth and for love. Please remain standing and let us join our voices together in our first hymn this morning, hymn number 322, Thanks Be for These.
Celebrate. So, Ken McLean, who was our minister from 1960 till 64, had planned to be here. He unfortunately was sandied in Bethesda, Maryland. He was there visiting his son and was unable to get a confirmed reservation out until today or tomorrow. So he sent me his remarks to share with you, which I am happy to do. This is about the merger of the Unitarian Church of Roslindale and the First Church West Roxbury, and the 250th anniversary that they celebrated shortly after the merger in 1962. The two churches, which had come out of the First Parish West Roxbury Church, in which Theodore Parker had preached in 1837 to 46, were only a mile apart, but they were not closely associated when the question of a merger came up in 1960. The Roslindale Church had not had a full-time minister for some years, but had ministers who were still students in the Harvard Divinity School and not yet in ministerial fellowship with the Unitarian Universalist Association. They were Virgil Murdoch, Brooks Walker, and Kenneth Torquille McLean, who became a full-time minister serving both churches in 1960. The church in Roslindale had a loyal membership with a few leading families who struggled to keep the church and parish house maintained to cover the building expenses and to pay their student ministers. I think particularly of the Allen, Davis, Grant, and Morse families whose members served on the board and the committees. Reverend John Wallace Laws had served for a number of years in the West Roxbury Church, where the Doolittle and Beaton families and Mrs. Roberta Forgy were among the leaders. In the spring of 1960, John Laws announced that he had accepted a call to the Unitarian Church in Waterville, Maine. At the same time, Kenneth McLean had graduated from the Harvard Divinity School. Leaders of the two churches discussed a possible joint ministry for the two congregations, with Ken McLean serving both. In October 1960, he began doing a service in Roslindale at 9:30, then picking up his robe and sermon and crossing over Belgrade Avenue for the West Roxbury service at 11. People began attending whichever service was convenient for them. And some referred to the arrangement as early mass and late mass. There was still strong resistance in Roslindale to a more complete merger, until it became clear that the furnace in the Roslindale church would need repairs costing in the neighborhood of $2,000. From the winter of 1960, for 2 years, a joint merger committee met and hammered out an agreement to constitute a reunited church meeting in West Roxbury with Ken McLean as minister. The reconstituted church was to be called the Theodore Parker Unitarian Church, as the West Roxbury Church was commonly referred to as Parker's Church. Or it was, perhaps they named it, perhaps it was referred to, and this is a sentence I didn't see, the community called the church the Parker Church, or perhaps it was they called it the Parker Church because of the statue on the front lawn. This statue, which had been commissioned to be placed on the Boston Common, ended up in West Roxbury because Theodore was still considered too controversial for the common. During this time, the Roslindale Church, like many Unitarian churches in eastern Massachusetts, held an annual church fair, a significant fundraiser for the budget. It was suggested that the church sponsor a church fair workshop. Churches all over the district were invited and asked to register. To their complete surprise, this congregation of about 50 expected 30 or 40 participants, but there were 140. Scottish oatcakes were served with coffee in the morning, followed by a beautiful lunch. The workshop was a great success. On the Sunday before Christmas, there was just one service in West Roxbury. On Easter Sunday, the church on Corey Street was closed, and the joint service was conducted in Roslindale. Kenneth Torquil McLean was ordained by both congregations on November 27, 1960. James Luther Adams preached the sermon, and Dorothy McNeil was the soloist. The final step of closing the Roslindale building and putting it up for sale took place at the end of October 1962, just in time to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the 1712 Third Church Roxbury. In the middle of that week, the minister's wife gave birth to a son, Derek Torquil McLean. He asked us not to tell you how old he is. I am sorry not to be with you for this great celebration of what has been achieved for the church in time for this great three-century anniversary. But the combination of Hurricane Sandy and other complications decided that I should be with you only through email. Theodore Parker could not have imagined the church which today bears his name. Theodore Parker could not have imagined the church. Theodore Parker could not have imagined the church which today bears his name, nor this way of communicating. But then, 50 years ago, neither could I. My love, gratitude, and congratulations are with you as you make clear that the spirit of liberal religion is still vital in Roslindale and Massachusetts in 2012. Signed, Reverend Dr. Kenneth Torquil McLean of Ranchero Mirage, California. And the minister who followed Ken is with us as well, Gordon Gibson.
There are more of you than I generally saw. Given one of the early events of my ministry, I was very fortunate to have Theodore Parker as a predecessor. And Ken McLean wasn't bad either. In late 1964, Unitarian Universalist ministers, including those just called to their churches, were being urged by our association to volunteer for week or 10-day stints working with the Delta Ministry of the National Council of Churches in Mississippi. I'd long been interested in civil rights issues, and so, with the agreement of the Standing Committee, I volunteered to go in early 1965. But then, a few weeks before the trip, the Unitarian Universalist Association asked me and another new minister in the Boston area to shift our focus and explore a new project that Dr. King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference was launching in a place I had never heard of till then, Selma, Alabama. I was formally ordained and installed by you, well, your predecessors, on January 31, 1965. I arrived in Selma on February 2nd and started serving a jail sentence for contempt of court on February 8th. I bless this congregation for being tolerant of their new young minister going to jail and then referencing civil rights with excessive frequency for several months thereafter. And I bless Theodore Parker for being the sort of predecessor who made many undertakings look moderate by comparison with him. On balance, it was a growth experience for me, and I think for the congregation as well. The congregation, when Judy and I arrived, was not young. As I recall, those we might have defined as young were 50, or maybe it was 55 and younger, and there were not many of them. Once we got the religious education program moving again, additional families showed up. We did some renovation and expansion in the basement of the parish house so that we had better religious education space. And ultimately, a few years later, we agreed to be a second-year test site for a cutting-edge new curriculum that the Unitarian Universalist Association was then developing, called About Your Sexuality. Because all of the Protestant congregations of West Roxbury were struggling in the late 1960s, it was agreed that we should attempt a joint youth group. I think this was at least moderately successful, but I particularly valued a spin-off benefit. The ministers of the Congregational, United Methodist, Baptist, and Unitarian Universalist churches felt that we needed to meet regularly to discuss the progress of the shared youth group. We agreed to meeting over breakfast, and at least for a time, were gathering weekly. These meetings led to some significant personal sharing as we became a source of mutual edification and support. With last week's hurricane, I was reminded yet again of one fruit of this clergy closeness. Judy and I moved from West Roxbury to Jackson, Mississippi, and were greeted almost immediately by Hurricane Katrina. The next Christmas, the Reverend Finley Keach, my Baptist colleague here in West Roxbury, wrote in his Christmas card to us that he had been unable to suppress a smile as he heard about Katrina and thought about us being baptized by something that sounded like it closely approached total immersion. In addition to this, there was some good interfaith sharing with the synagogue down Corey Street and the Catholic churches. I remember with particular warmth Monsignor Charles Finn, whose career included serving as rector of the seminary when a young man named Richard Cushing was studying for the priesthood, and serving as advisor to the Newman Club at Harvard when Joe Kennedy was president of the Newman Club. Monsignor Finn was in his 90s when he and I were colleagues. Richard Cushing was the Cardinal Bishop of Boston, and Joe Kennedy's kid, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, had been the first Catholic elected president. A matriarch of the congregation when I served it was Roberta Forgy. She was in her 80s at that point and held no formal office, but she had a significant voice in determining what we would do or would not do. There were issues, mostly social issues like the war in Vietnam, on which Mrs. Forgy and I held strongly divergent views. I still hold her up as a model of how to disagree without being in any way disagreeable. We had excellent conversations about our viewpoints, agreed to disagree if necessary, and remained people who valued each other. A congregation full of Roberta Forgies would be an exciting and rewarding place to do ministry. It truly would. And so I urge you to emulate her forthrightness, her dedication to this institution, and her embodiment of a rich tolerance.
And many of you remember the next minister who is joining us, our lovely Lillian Nye.
A strange but oh so familiar feeling. So we have to think about, let's say you completed in around 1970, so 30 years after that point. So that's a lot of history that we unfortunately don't have the voices to tell us that story this morning. But I entered this sanctuary for the first time in May 2002. I was candidating for the ministry that had opened up since Reverend Robert Haney had retired from his 20-year tenure. And the congregation was just about to complete the restoration of this space after a long period of preparation and raising the necessary capital to do it. But that spring, when I first came here, it was still very much the worse for wear. It was like the Velveteen Rabbit. Tattered, threadbare, faded, with its stuffing coming out of various holes. And this is partly metaphor, but also partly literal, in reference to the horsehair pew cushions, which were probably the 19th century originals. Its condition was a testimony to the difficult and lean decades during which the congregation was tiny and stretched and strapped. But also, like the Velveteen Rabbit, this sanctuary, this church, was so loved. And like the Velveteen Rabbit, it was very real for having been so loved. So in spite of its tattered and patched appearance, it was the love and the vivid sense of character and the realness and vitality of the community that drew me here. And by the time I came back 3 months later as the newly called minister, the sanctuary restoration was virtually complete. And what an incredible transformation it was. So from tattered, threadbare, and faded to newly plastered, painted, polished, and brightened. The spanking new royal blue pew cushions and the plush burgundy carpets came soon after, and its restored condition showed off the artistry of the architectural design and gave new glory to the already glorious windows. Now, I don't mean to spend these precious moments focusing on the buildings or the many repairs and refurbishes and restorations that occurred during my time with the congregation, but I begin with the restoration of the sanctuary because, in some sense, it seemed like a demarcation between two congregational identities, two stories. One story was of a lean survival against all odds, the little church that could. The predominant memories were of the congregation's wonderful characters, many of which had since moved on either from the neighborhood or from this world altogether. The tiny community's resourceful and often eccentric traditions, and the rebirth of the church's religious education program. But alongside those beloved memories were those of buckets placed in the sanctuary on rainy days to catch the leaks coming from the roof and the plaster, and the many Sunday mornings when there were some 12 people in the sanctuary. The new story that was emerging was one of tremendous possibility, of growth and forward momentum. There was new congregational pride and confidence, the sense of wanting to reach out to the larger world, to both welcome others into this church home, but also to be a significant part of West Roxbury and beyond, and to be of service to that larger world. So the restoration of the sanctuary in the summer of 2002 may not have been the most necessary project from the standpoint of the building's needs, as there were many things that needed to be addressed, but it was the most essential, most necessary accomplishment from the standpoint of the congregation's morale. The transformation catalyzed a tremendous leap forward in optimism and excitement, and my arrival at that time was like a surfer catching a fabulous wave. So as I reflect on my time with Theodore Parker Church, looking back over the very broad sweep of things, one theme seems most consistent to me. The process by which the congregation stays connected to its history and the story of its past while undertaking necessary evolution and change. One of the characteristics that makes this congregation unique is that it's both steeped in history but also inventive, creative, and flexible. The fact that this church nearly went extinct 25 years ago and yet pulled itself back from the brink and went on to survive and truly thrive was because the community was able to re-envision itself and reinvent its practices over and over and over. So unlike many churches with 300-year histories, there's no tired refrain here of, "But we've always done it that way." More typical here is the sentiment of, well, necessity is the mother of invention. And so the community has had to be willing to try new things, to explore and embrace what works now in the midst of the present, in the midst of growth and change and development, rather than to cling to what is familiar, even as dear as the familiar is. So over our 10 years together, between 2002 and 2012, there was a steady stream of talented, spirited, and generous people who joined forces with the more established members. And each newcomer brought his or her new vitality and gifts, time, and hope to the church. Each discovered the story of the congregation's past struggles and its renaissance. Each person learned its deep historical significance. And yet each also introduced an entirely new energy to the whole. So like many fresh streamlets joining an ancient river, all worked together, the newcomers, the mid-timers, the long-timers, to contribute to a steady, continuous, forward evolution of Theodore Parker Church's sense of itself and its possibilities. There's an essential heart and spirit to this place, this community. It's both intangible and yet very palpable. I can't directly name what that big heart is, but it can always be felt and found in the midst of people's caring for each other and for your church. While I can't name its essence, its constellation of qualities, as I experience it, are creativity, laughter, love, devotion, participation. Did I say participation? Service, hard work, big forgiveness, flexibility, honesty, continuous open searching, a scrappy can-do fortitude, and undying hope. These are the qualities that make all the hard stuff worth it. These are the qualities that drew me and sustained me and allowed me to grow and develop in your midst from a wet-behind-the-ears newbie minister to a relatively seasoned one. I believe that that spirit has been here from the beginning. It was a flame lit by the community that came together in 1712, and it's been kept burning through all the generations of change, through all the ebbs and flows of history, writ large and small, through all the seasons of darkness and light, dearth and abundance, loss and rebirth. And it's here in great strength today. So regardless of whatever necessary changes in practice may come, this heart, this spirit, is the true treasure to be guarded for all the future generations.
Our second hymn is number 354. We'll sing verses 1 and 4, We Laugh, We Cry. Together in the spirit of prayer and meditation. Spirit of life and love, with grateful hearts we give thanks for these 300 years and for the people who tended this faith year after year, decade after decade, honored the heritage they had been given by caring for and passing on this living tradition. On this Sunday of celebration, as we observe this joyful history, Let us also turn our thoughts and prayers to those beyond our doors who suffer and have lost so much in the recent hurricane, as we turn our thoughts and prayers to people everywhere who are afflicted and grieve. Our hearts go out to them. And let us now be together in a time of silence, that we may each offer an unspoken prayer of the Spirit.
Theodore Parker Church is fortunate that they hired Reverend Richard Kimball in 1980. Dick began to aggressively recruit new members. He was much loved and attracted a number of enthusiastic, energetic young people who began to attend in the mid-80s. They joined with the then elderly members and attenders of the church and began the long road of turning their ship around. We were also lucky that Dick's friend, Reverend Robert Haney, joined him. After Dick became ill and could not continue, Bob took up the reins of diffident leader whose charm, good humor, and extraordinary worship services helped keep spirits up and all focused on the prize. At the instigation of Reverend Tim Ashton and the Mass Bay District of the UUA, the Weston UU Church shared their ministerial interns, sent volunteers to help clean up, paint, plant, and repair, and provided funds to help cover the necessity in those lean years. Today, we are blessed to have a number of these 1980 pioneers still actively involved in the ongoing life of the church. They are here and will be sharing with us this morning their remembrances. And what was it that they saw that kept them involved and continuing to put their shoulders to the wheel? I'd like to say each person that's listed in your leaflet will be coming up to share with you a short remembrance. And at the end of the service, would you also join us at the door so that people can share with you their thanks and remembrances as well? John and Cecilia, shall you start off?
So the church is 300 years old. Wow. Even more amazing for Cecilia and me to contemplate is that we've been part of its history for fully 10% of that time. Indeed, it is true that 2012 marks the 30th anniversary of our joining this church community, which was during the time it was infused with a burst of energy provided by Reverend Richard Kimball's ministry that was sadly cut short by illness. I sought out the church because of Dick. I was raised a Unitarian in Britain, where Unitarians are rarer than four-leafed clover, the grandson of a Unitarian minister, which makes me rarer still. In 1961, when I was 10 years old, our small church in Stockport, an industrial town in northern England famous for felt hat manufacturing, had as its minister for about 2 years a young American freshly graduated from divinity school. It was Dick. And Dick would want me to tell you it was Harvard Divinity School. When we moved to Boston in 1982, I came to work in the newly emerging biotechnology industry. I remembered that Dick was from Boston. We found that there were two Richard Kimballs listed in the phone book. Google had not yet been invented. And we called the one that had Reverend in front of his name. As a scientist, I have good powers of deduction. He invited us to Easter Sunday service and to his house for lunch afterwards. It was wonderful for me to rejoin a UU congregation and for Cecilia to join her first one, and for us both to learn about Theodore Parker and the rich Unitarian and Universalist history in New England. Like the biotech company I joined, the church has gone through a couple of very near-death experiences. The church first contemplated closing in the mid-1970s, and in the mid-1980s, when Dick became ill and could not continue his ministry, the congregation quickly withered to a very few. But call me stubborn, I think Cecilia would agree, an eternal optimist, whatever, I just could not give up easily on the church. Perhaps it was simply not wanting to let newfound friends down and let Dick down. Perhaps it was the bumper sticker, WWGD. What would grandfather do? Perhaps it was the thought that how could any good UU let a church congregation that counted Theodore Parker amongst its ministers, indeed named for him, just fade away? And we didn't. A few of us nurtured the barely flickering flame back to life with the help of many along the way. Reverend Bob Haney, Reverend Tim Ashton and the Mass Bay District of UU Churches, First Parish Western, to name a few. But how to start? How to get people to know we are still here? How to get people through the door and see the beauty within? Yard sales.
Yes, 30 years of coming to this church and still coming. Oh, my. What kept me coming? I must say, in the beginning, it was the yard sales. In the early years, I organized the twice-yearly yard sales. Since I've made such a long career of working very hard at activities that generate very little money, they were a natural for me. Cooking meals for the West Roxbury Women's Group who met in the church hall, giving slideshows on hiking in the California Sierras, and drawing various members and driving various members to and from church, and even grocery shopping, gave John and me a variety of opportunities to be of service. Later on, becoming a youth group leader has been rewarding as well. Remembering my own teenage years and my sense of limitless opportunities that awaited me if only I choose the right college major. A real joy was the opportunity to make a fool of myself through organizing the Theodore Parker Tahitian Dance Troupe, several members of which are in the audience today. Raise your hands. Which was even invited back for an encore performance, giving us the chance to improve upon our costumes, if not the precision of our dance moves. I also kept coming to try to figure out what I really believe. Being a lapsed Catholic of German and British ancestry from the Midwest, I came to realize that I was still trying in some obtuse way to do what I needed to do to get to heaven. The question of what do I really believe never became so compelling as when I joined the church and was encouraged to figure it out for myself, rather than be told what I should believe. But perhaps what most keeps me coming to this church is hope. I'm fine. Here with me. Hope that there would be another fashion show. Like the one I was fortunate enough to participate in back in 1983, where I got to model a beautiful Princess Diana replica wedding dress. Walking down that aisle up to the front of the church. After which I sent photos to out-of-town friends claiming I'd gotten married again. I did. But in lieu of another fashion show, I'd settle for a spiritual exploration group focusing on scarf tying to help me figure out what more I can do with all those scarves I've picked up at the yard sales over the years. Seriously, though, most of all, I enjoy the people, some like John and myself who joined in the 80s and others who've joined more recently and are yet to join out there in the collective consciousness of wanting to be part of a congregation like this, making this church ever renewed and interesting.
Cecilia, I don't know how you follow that, but I'll try. Back in the late 80s, I was a couple of years out of college, and I had just moved to West Roxbury. I was looking for a Unitarian church in my community. Being the only choice, I was sort of predisposed, I think, to like it here. I remember my first Sunday very clearly. I walked in and sat down, and it just had a spiritual feel to it. I didn't notice the green peeling paint. I didn't notice the crumbling tower. And after Bob Haney's sermon, I think I was pretty much sold. And then in true Theodore Parker style, Ruth Davis grabbed me by the hand. Ruth and her husband, John Davis, were very active back in the Gibson time, and escorted me back to coffee hour. She had made some homemade brownies, and I think the whole pan fed the church, and there might have been some leftovers. And so I think after that first Sunday, it really packed a wallop, and I think has never disappointed me since. And I was the last of the group in the 80s, I think, to join, and you could see why you would just want to be part of the community. And I think a Sunday or two passed, and then John Lambert said to me, "Would you like to be on the membership committee?" So I said, "Well, sure." And then shortly thereafter, we're starting up an intern committee with Weston. Would you like to do that? Yes. And then came the request for the standing committee. And many people have asked me, you know, it must have been so much work back then. And it never felt like much work. And it doesn't feel like much work now. You know, when we all are together in community, it just makes such a difference. And I can tell you the one thing that I was not looking for when I came to church was a husband. And I did happen to find Doug along the way. So I'll let him speak next.
Why did I come here, and why did I keep coming back? I've asked myself that question many times. At times, I feared my departure would lead to collapse. At other times, the church was an experience so unique and surreal, not even the greatest author could contrive it. From coming my first day and planting a tree with a kitchen knife out in the area there, watching the sexton at our inaugural canvas dinner doing a sand dance with a jar of sugar up at the front of the stage. But overall, it was truly the people who formed the community like no other. Nowhere could I find a core of individuals who could couple their finely honed sense of humor, irony, intellect, and optimism with their spiritual theology. There are many moments of crisis or despair, but then would come a Sunday where visitors with names like Stan and Julie would appear from the ether, introduce themselves to me at coffee hour, and ask me if we were the kind of church they could get involved in. I would always say it was a church worth getting involved in, a church that had something like no other, and a church you will always remember. It is, in fact, all of you who make us the unique and unforgettable church that we are. My only regret is that I can't look back over the past 300 years and see all of the people who have been here over other places that have really made up the continuity and the continuum that have existed from then till now. And I only look forward to the next 100 years and imagine what will it be like at the 400th anniversary. In closing, I look back. We were desperate. We found a way to get past, and we were so desperate that I held off hitting on the really sharp fox that was visiting us, and over a year later, then asked out my soon-to-be wife after that. Thank you.
So I asked myself the same question that Doug just asked. I came, why did I come, and why did I come back? I first walked through the doors of Theodore Parker Church on Mother's Day of 1983 with my four-year-old son, Brendan, who is now 34, so you can do the math. Brendan was attending a preschool in Rosendale at the time that happened to be next to the Rosendale Congregational Church that many of you know on Cummins Highway. Our family didn't go to church. I didn't particularly feel the need to go to church. I had left the Christian Science Church of my childhood, which never was a good fit for me. But Brendan started getting very interested in church buildings. He wanted to know what they looked like inside. All his little friends went to church, and so we started visiting churches, starting with the Rosendale Congregational Church, where people were very nice to us. Then we came here a couple of weeks later, and it happened to be Mother's Day. We walked in, and there were, I don't know, 8 or 10 or 12 people here. I think Doug was probably here at the time. I'm not sure, and John certainly was, John Lambert and Cecilia. But mostly everybody was kind of 60 or 70 or 80 years old. And when I walked in with this four-year-old in tow, I felt like all eyes were, you know, like, let's get them and keep them. Don't let them leave. So we sat over there, and Dick Kimball preached. And Dick was a very dynamic, very warm, friendly person. And I felt very comfortable here. We went to coffee hour. Everybody was very nice to us. But then for some reason, we didn't come back for a year. And I don't know why. I think there just weren't enough people here, and I just wasn't really ready to take this on. But in the course of the next year, I connected with a wonderful dear friend, Marjorie Correa, who some of you will remember, who happened to sing in the same chorus that I was in, and she happened to be one of the other few young people who was attending here. Now, Marjorie had a son, Adam, who was exactly the same age as Brendan. I had a younger son who by that time he was four, and then we had a soloist, Corin Potter, who had a son who was exactly the same age as Owen. So Marjorie and I started thinking, you know, we've got enough for a Sunday school here. We've got four kids. And we both were very, very committed to, first of all, we were committed to the idea of religious education, but it had to be on our own terms. We wanted to be very sure that our children were going to be learning what we wanted them to learn, and we just were control freaks, and we just really wanted to be able to monitor everything. So obviously the answer was to start a Sunday school at Theodore Parker Church. There was none. There were no children. So we launched our first little Sunday school probably around 1985, I would say. And we had no materials. We had no curriculum. We just had a couple of moldy rooms in the basement. We were kind of making it up as we went along. Marjorie, luckily, was a teacher, so she had a few skills. I had no skills whatsoever. But we managed. And the kids seemed to be having a good time. Then a little while later, Dick Kimball, the minister, brought Bob Haney along. And very few people will remember this, but Bob was actually a Sunday school teacher here before he was our minister. And, you know, Bob did not have children. He was really not used to little boys at all. And Bob would emerge at the end of the hour, you know, pale and trembling. You know, because he had had these lovely little lessons planned where the kids were going to draw pictures of animals and he was going to, you know, and the whole hour became a question of getting them to sit down and sit still. But somehow we got through all of this. And I think because we had this little core group of four kids, the next few families who came saw that there was something here. So we expanded, you know, child by child. You know, we got up to six and eight, and we were lucky that they were all sort of the same age starting out, so we could have one class. But then we started to grow a little bit, and somewhere along the line, we had developed this relationship with the Weston Church, and it's so nice to have Barbara here. Barbara, wherever she's sitting, I hear Barbara Coburn, who provided us with all kinds of wonderful materials. And Marjorie and I went over there and met with their director of religious education. So we started using some wonderful materials, holidays and holy days, which I think we still use. But it was a fabulous experience for me to be part of a startup that I think was largely responsible for the slow growth of the church. And over the years, the place started to feel more like a going concern. I'm going to leave you with one story that I just love to think about. In the early days when we were very small, our fellowship dinners included the kids. We could do it because there weren't that many people. And we used to do little skits involving the kids. One of our curriculum units that year had been a great book called Travel in Time, where we built a time machine out of a refrigerator box and put all kinds of dials and things on it. And every Sunday, the kids would dial back to a certain year, and they would emerge from their refrigerator box, and we would be in the time of Michael Servetus or James Reeb or, some of the heroes of Unitarian Universalism. Well, for our skit for the Canvas dinner, we decided that we would have a malfunction of our refrigerator box time machine, and it would send us to the future rather than to the past, as we've been doing all year. So we emerged, I think, about 100 years in the future. The kids came out of the box, and here we were at Theodore Parker Church, where there was a monorail running down Center Street. We had all kinds of futuristic stuff going on. But Doug and Carol, I will never forget this, I don't know if you remember this, dressed up in clean suits, white suits, and they made these helmets. They covered their bicycle helmets with aluminum foil, and somehow did some sort of an antenna sticking out of the top, so they were the congregants of the future. But the closing song of our little skit was "This Little Light of Mine, I'm Gonna Let It Shine." And so we ended with this wonderful sense of hope that we had turned this place around, that there in fact was a future for Theodore Parker Church, that 100 years or 200 years from then, we would still be there, maybe not with bicycle helmets with antenna sticking out, but as a vibrant community, multi-generational, full of kids, full of wonderful volunteers. And it's been, the association I've had with this church has just been one of the most important of my life, and I'm just so grateful for everybody who was here to start and who saw it through the leaks and the restorations and the many crises we had, and to look out at all of you here and the pews so full is just such a moving experience for me. So I just want to thank everybody for staying with us and coming.
So I am not one of the stalwarts from the 80s, but have been an observer since the early 80s. Ann and I moved to West Roxbury in 1979 so that I could take an assistant professor position at Northeastern. Ann soon found work with Oxfam America. Despite incomes that had the bank loan officer looking at us skeptically, we were able to purchase a very nice house because real estate prices were just starting to recover from the white flight that accompanied the court-ordered busing to integrate Boston's public schools. Feelings from those confrontations still ran high and led to our first contact with the Theodore Parker Church. Our neighbors across the street, Louise and Al Washington and their family, were the target, they're one of the few black families in West Roxbury, were the target of a couple of late-night racist incidents shortly after we moved in. We got a call from another West Roxbury resident asking if we would be willing to join with them, a few other neighbors, and Richard Kimball, the minister of the Unitarian Church, to meet with the Washingtons to show that there was neighborhood support. We did so, and that was the beginning of our connection to the TPC. Anne joined the TPC almost immediately, but I held back. Frankly, although I knew that I was a UU at heart, I didn't want to join because that would mean a commitment and accompanying guilt. I didn't think I had enough time or interest to help out, and anyway, wasn't the situation hopeless? Sunday attendance was typically a dozen or so, and the physical plant was a mess, absolutely hopeless. Other than the Tiffany windows, the place was ugly and run down. The dingy green paint was peeling, plaster was falling, the old seat cushions were full of dust, and now I understand horsehair, which made me allergic every time I came into the building. Exterior walls needed mortar, ironwork was rusting, etc., etc. What did the stalwarts see? Either they were so imaginative they could see a more marvelous future, or so unimaginative they couldn't realize that the place was fading away. So, what were the turning points? My impressions are no doubt different from those of others, but I remember the Sunday that Gretchen O'Neill walked in with a child in tow, and all 10 of us in attendance turned and looked in amazement and excitement. I learned just last night that our eager response scared her off for a year or so. But when she joined, I think it started an upward trend, and we just heard that indeed it did. Another symbolic turning point was the marriage of Doug Armstrong and Carol Thomas in the TPC sanctuary. In order to have a less seedy-looking place to be married, a volunteer effort was organized to paint the entrance hall. I'm not sure the paint was dry in time for the wedding. But I do remember thinking for the first time that this place really could look nice if some effort and some finances could be invested. Of course, as a non-member, I was insulated from many other Herculean efforts to keep and improve the church property. While for many years my contribution was to attend occasionally and bring rhubarb pies to special occasions, John Lambert and Cecilia Bennett, Doug Armstrong and Carol Thomas, Gretchen O'Neill, Anne Forsyth, and there were others who are no longer really part of the congregation now, slowly built a TPC community. We now have at TPC a wonderful community of people who care about each other and about peace, social justice, the environment, and who don't try to convert each other to a single brand of spiritual thought. We owe our thanks to those who carried this community through the leanest of times.
Came here, I could walk like hop, skip, and jump, but I'm also aging. But I do want, first of all, to send my congratulations. First Parish congratulates you and wishes you another 100 years of success. I was back in the here in the days when we used to have some work parties with the few people that were here, and I remember having clearing out places, and up there was stuff up in the balcony up there that was, and I guess it was getting ready for all these yard sales you had. Or, but we had a wonderful time, and I know that the student minister or the interns that you had from our church enjoyed their stay here very much, and particularly Richard Trudeau, I think some of you may remember, and Jenny Rankin and Marianne Powers, and they spent their they spent 1 year with us and then would come over to you. And I think that it was a help to Bob Haney. And I remember that the Halers, by the way, I talked to them yesterday, and they send their greetings. They're living out in the West Coast now, retired, and still very healthy. But I called them to make sure I was correct on a few things, and we just talked about your church and how wonderful it's to see it this way. It was very small, and it's fun to welcome back, to see the people that I do know, and I hope I can get to know a few more of you in the coffee hour. It's a special place. I can understand why the way you feel about it. It's your place, and it's wonderful. Thank you.
In the spirit of generosity, the offertory will now be given and gratefully received for the ongoing good works of this church.
Greetings, congratulations, huzzah! My name is Laura Graham, and I am so pleased to be back here with you today for this joyful celebration of your resilience, courage, and faith in one another for now these 300 years. Please know that I am in fact carrying the greetings of your sister congregations, the congratulations and the esteem of my fellow board members of the Mass Bay District, and the particular greetings of our Mass Bay District President, Sue Phillips, who wishes she could have been here in person to celebrate with you, but was prevented by a prior engagement. So she asked me to take great care to convey her very warmest regards and congratulations. As representative of the district, I want to lift up the power and tenacity of our associational covenant, the covenant between and among us that gets to the core of our UU identity. We are UUs. We don't promise one another conformity of belief. We don't promise one another smooth sailing. We don't promise to agree on much beyond our principles, but we covenant to journey together while we pursue our sometimes separate paths on our individual searches for truth and meaning. We celebrate our unique identities and cherish our autonomy. We struggle and we contend with one another, and we do so with a commitment to remain in association with one another. We are not bystanders. We are not simply cheerleaders. In our relationship with one another, at the sacred heart of the covenant between us, there is no me and you, no us and them. There is only us and we. And this we is made only richer by the recognition and celebration of our differences. Our associational covenant is as clear an expression of our interdependence as I can imagine. Sue Phillips likes to describe districts as the architecture of our interdependence, and I love that description. When a congregation faces hard times, it is good to know that we do not struggle alone, to know that we are a beloved member of a larger family, and that someone outside our walls cares what happens to us. And it is a joyful thing to know, when there is cause for celebration, that our sister congregations celebrate alongside us. And when a congregation receives help from the district, as all of us do from time to time, it helps to remember that the district help is the manifestation of our reciprocal commitment to one another. As the architecture of our interdependence, the district is one of the ways we make us happen, the way we are able to unite and be of service to one another. The district is not out there outside us. It is us. We are it. And what a joy to be together today.
I have been asked to read a letter from the Reverend Peter Morales, the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association, which he sends to us. Dear members of the Theodore Parker Church, I am writing to congratulate you on the wonderful occasion of the 300th anniversary. This is such a great milestone to achieve. You have come a long way and done so much since your origin in 1712. The Theodore Parker Church has been a voice of our values across the years and become a compassionate home that opens its arms to the wider community. You have seen many vibrant ministers, developed a strong religious education program, and have built a beautiful place to worship. You also engage in important social justice work, including addressing the important topic of immigration and raising money for victims of domestic violence. Be proud of the work that you have done. And as you look to your future, I encourage you to dream boldly. As you look for your next minister, find the voice of change that will lead you to be your best selves. I can't wait to see what you accomplish. Congratulations on behalf of all of us here at the Unitarian Universalist Association. Sincerely, the Reverend Peter Morales, President. Thank you for the meaningful look from Phyllis. Julie, you can stand up, and please come forward. We just want to take this moment this morning, and first of all, give you a big hug, and thank you for doing such an utterly remarkable job in organizing all of the events that have made up this year of celebration. The creativity, the organization, the hard work, the assembling of a great team. Would everybody who's on Julie's team please stand up and also share in this recognition? Thank you so much for getting us closer to our history and being able to celebrate it in such style. Oh,
thank you. Thank you. I have nothing to say. It's getting too late. This afternoon, there's a lot more to say.
We're going to sing just one verse of the final hymn, which is number 318.
Thank you.
300-year milestone, as Peter Morales has said, calls for bold dreams. The future of this congregation and this religious movement depend on today's dreams for tomorrow's vision. May they ever show us the way. So may it be. Amen.